The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
For today's interview, we reached out to two people, Jenna Van Drenen, a director of the Basic Income Canada Network, and Mark Lee, senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. To my knowledge, there aren't folks in this segment with current lived experience of poverty, and I want to note that the perspectives featured here are just a portion of the whole, that this segment can serve as a starting point, but not as a complete picture. First, here's Mark with what basic income is and what this report set out to achieve.
Basic income, or a guaranteed annual income, has been an idea that's been around for many decades, and it comes in and goes in different flavors. It was really part of the agreement between the Green Party and the BC NDP. Initially, it was to do a pilot on basic income, you know, a test of the proposition. But with the NDP lead, I think they decided they wanted instead to just study it. And they appointed a panel of three economics professors. The head of it is actually a research associate of ours at CCPA, David Green. And they basically set out to, you know, figure out what we knew about basic income through various experiments that have happened around the world, to do some modeling about what basic income would look like in BC and, you know, various parameters on it and how much those different things would cost. They then also studied the kind of hodgepodge of existing programs that we have spread across many ministries, you know, in particular housing and income assistance. And then they also wrapped it all up, even though for a bunch of economics professors, they did a wonderful job of weaving justice in as a, you know, framing principle for how they were approaching the idea of basic income or what, you know, a better system of income security should look like in British Columbia. And they really emphasized the idea of a just society as kind of the overarching objective. The panel report itself essentially didn't get very much media coverage at all. I saw a few headlines saying, you know, panel rejects basic income only as the pejorative there. But what was not said very clearly is that the panel did actually recommend some very fundamental overhauls to income security and economic security and housing and a bunch of other areas that, if enacted, would dramatically reduce poverty in British Columbia and do sort of, you know, fairly low cost to the public purse.
Thanks, Mark. Could you dig into some of what those recommendations were? Because like you said, they were pretty large calls.
Yeah, so you're right. So even though the panel rejected a basic income across the board, like a universal basic income, like everyone in British Columbia gets $20,000. They just said, okay, that's ridiculously expensive. And then they even rejected variants of that, whether it be as kind of a smaller amount and it would phase out, similar to what we would do with old age security or the Canada Child Tax Benefit. They also said that is more plausible, but it would still be costly and that money needs to come from somewhere. But the one area where they did recommend a basic income was people who are currently on disability assistance, and also just the whole process for accessing disability benefits in the first place. So, you know, that would be like a major increase in the benefit rates, the amount that that people on disability get, and just the overall, you know, level of other supports and how those relate to the ability to earn additional income without having it penalized dollar for dollar off of your income assistance. So I think that's an area where there's a lot of promise, you know, where it's a very clear cut case that you know, people who have limited access to paid work, you should have a full basic income. In addition to just income, the panel looks at public services, so enhanced public services for people with low incomes, particularly things like dental care, where, you know, a large percentage of the population gets dental benefits through employer-paid plans. I'm one of those people, for example, whereas there are a lot of people who get left out, particular working poor households from dental benefits. So some kind of more broad-based benefit there would be beneficial. The benefit of the report is that, you know, it tries to look sort of comprehensively around, you know, what are the dimensions of poverty and then how do we actually achieve those? And, you know, recognizing that it's a mix of you know, income supports and public services and housing supports was another area, but also some target interventions. So one of the major gaps they found in the current system was the supporting youth in transition out of foster care. So allocating funding there, you know, would have a really, you know, important impact where it's really needed, where there's a current gap. They also found this other gap, which is actually a pretty big one, which is around sort of the idea of like the dignity and accessibility of work. That is so much low wage work and just a lack of really good jobs for certain folks who are kind of trapped in low wage work. So again, there's a lot we could do here in terms of having more unionization in the low wage service sector, higher minimum wages, you know, other changes to employment standards to improve the working conditions in that area. So that's one that goes beyond the idea of the basic income to sort of more fundamental reforms to the labor market so that the labor market for those able to work is delivering higher wages and allowing people to get out of poverty that way.
What do you think, Mark, about this idea that I've heard from basic income advocates that having this sort of approach taken in the report of targeted basic income creates groups of people who are worthy of basic income and those who are unworthy of basic income? The follow-up thought to that is that the government should not have the power to decide who is deserving and undeserving.
Well, it's interesting because they do kind of make that distinction in their recommendations, you know, as we noted, around basic income for people with disabilities and not for the rest of the working age population. But they do, early on in their kind of more philosophical, analytical approach, really talk about how, you know, the framework should be about justice, you know, more fundamentally. You know, how that can lead to sort of more inclusive approaches rather than, you know, deserving versus undeserving poor, which is kind of more of a charity model that that has often been thought about in this area. So I think they kind of wrestle with those things. And I mean, ultimately, I think they're economists. They're interested in, you know, trying to have as much of an impact on poverty as possible, but also concerned about the fact that you have to raise revenues in order to achieve those ends. And so there needs to be ability to raise those revenues. And both the programs themselves and the way you raise the revenues have to be perceived as more broadly fair among the public at large in order to sort of pass that sort of key political hurdle. So I think that's even kind of getting at some of what you're talking about in the original question around these distinctions between deserving and undeserving and how we can actually have a just society and a floor on poverty and, you know, eradicating homelessness, you know, things like that really ought to be a front and center in terms of where we're at in public policy right now, not kind of an afterthought.
Mark, let me ask you about this. On one hand, the report talks about how basic income would create disincentives to work. And on the other hand, I've heard basic income advocates say that much valuable work in our society, such as caring for seniors or caring for children, is underpaid or unpaid. And so the disincentives to work framework may not be entirely holistic here. What do you make of that tension?
I haven't looked at that myself, but you know, I do tend to think that the work disincentive stuff is overplayed relative to if we had a society where there were abundant good jobs, where people got the job satisfaction that, you know, I get out of my job and that, you know, hopefully you do out of your job, then those things kind of fall away. But, you know, we have a system where, you know, you get trapped in low income cycles and you're forced to work really shitty service jobs, then, Yeah, sure, there would be a disincentive if you were able to access a generous basic income. So, you know, in part, it's really about the type of society we want to create. And that's where that idea of reciprocity comes into play. Like, why shouldn't someone who's doing a low wage job get paid well so they can have a decent living? We learned that from COVID, that, you know, these healthcare workers who are so exposed to a risk right now and potentially getting sick and dying themselves, you know, these, you know, paid so poorly that we, you know, had to increase their wages. So, I mean, that's the type of lesson that we should be applying more broadly economy wide. We should have a floor on poverty, whether that's, especially if you're working, you know, full time, full year, at any job, you should not be living in poverty. And so we have too much wealth at the extreme end and too much poverty at the bottom end. Let's squish it all together and build a just society. Across those 65 recommendations, if we implemented that as a package in the next few years, the cost to the Treasury would be very low. I think it's about, you know, 5 to 10% maximum of what our current budget is. And we would have this massive impact on poverty that we all benefit from. Like, you know, if we have no more homeless encampments and people sleeping on the street, I think we all benefit from that, not just the people who are currently homeless. So, you know, to think about the type of society that we want to build and then allocate resources to doing that. I mean, that's classic, you know, about what government is. And hopefully this report becomes a wake-up call and has a realistic framework set out by, you know, hard-nosed economists who've studied this stuff and who are making really practical recommendations to improve the system. So at the end of the day, it's not a basic income, but it has a lot of basic income-like features that are worth supporting. And I believe the Green Party that initially wanted the basic income pilot really approves of the recommendations in the report too.
And here's Jenna Van Drenen of the Basic Income Canada Network. She agrees with many of the recommendations of the expert panel, but thinks that basic income should still be implemented.
I'll start off by saying, so the Basic Income Canada Network, of which I am a part, is, so we're a voluntary nonprofit. We're national in scope. And so we advocate for a national basic income. And to be honest, I was, you know, disappointed in the findings of the BC report. I think that one of the things that it highlighted for me was the difficulty in designing and implementing a basic income at the provincial level. And you could also compare and contrast the findings of the BC report with, for example, a recent report that was released in PEI. So Prince Edward Island also had a special committee on poverty that released a report, and they actually concluded almost the opposite of what this particular report in BC concluded, and they called for the creation of a full basic income guarantee program that maintains PEI's social programs and services and supports people with low income. So this PEI report also, of course, acknowledged the need to negotiate with the federal government and to work at a national level. I think what the report highlighted was the difficulty in implementing an income security system at a provincial level that's, you know, disconnected from national income security policy. The BC government's expert panel did not recommend a livable basic income, but several of their recommendations I and we at the Basic Income Canada Network do agree with. So unfortunately, I think the report sort of set basic income up as an either-or proposition, you know, a bit of a dichotomy. And really, instead, I and most other advocates that I work with and know consider basic income to be yes and. So instead of, you know, focusing on do we fix existing services and supports or do we do a basic income, actually we need both, and we need both very desperately. So I really supported many of the panel's recommendations to improve and enhance BC's social services and supports, like extended healthcare benefits, housing supports, work supports, like labor regulation reforms, education and training. And I also think to me, some of the philosophical things that were missing were ways that we could redesign the income security system to promote dignity and freedom for people who are receiving income assistance right now. And I think that's one of the huge advantages of a basic income that that really is missing from some of the recommendations.
Jenna, what would you say to someone with this perspective, that there are only so many resources in the province and that there are many people in need of support, but there are some groups who really, really need it, such as young adults who have experience in the foster care system, or single working mothers, for example, and that instead of implementing an overall basic income, we should focus our resources on those who are in dire need of it?
Well, I think there are ways that you could provide basic income to people who need it without having conditionality. So I think there is a way of targeting, perhaps based on income, that doesn't include some of those conditions. And what we see right now in the existing income support systems is a host of conditionalities. And when we have those, buckets that people fall into, there inevitably are gaps. And there's many, many people who get left out. And that's one of the challenges with the existing income security system, is how many people fall through the cracks. So I think that in targeting, you do actually really risk leaving people out. And those people who get left out are among the most vulnerable and among those who need the most support. So I don't necessarily agree that cost effectiveness is the reason for targeting. And I think that there are several examples. So our Basic Income Canada Network has released a policy options report. It's available on our website, basicincomecanada.org. And leading economists have actually designed three different models for how basic income could be fully costed and funded within the existing income tax and transfer system, and actually in a progressive way that involves some redistribution of taxes to basically cover those who need it. And so when you do that kind of targeting, there's a few different versions of basic income, a few different ways you could do it. You could have a universal model and then an income-tested model. And so if we're talking about targeting, I think an income-tested approach is a much more effective way of targeting an income security system that doesn't, require people to check boxes like being a single mother or having a disability or any of the other conditions that are existing, or, some of the ones that were recommended by the BC report. So I think it's really a missed opportunity to provide a foundational floor for everyone to stand on, rather than these, buckets that people have to fall into in order to qualify for the support that we really all need and deserve.
I think what I'm hearing, Jenna, is that you're saying that the system is so flawed, is broken, and that we should, instead of trying to fix it or patch it, we should introduce a new system.
We have social assistance systems right now that are damaging people. They're actively damaging people. And this is entirely connected to anti-racism. And I want to, center that, because February is Black History Month. You are, interviewing me from a co-op radio station in the downtown East Side. These issues are fundamentally important to our social reform. And so we have a system, unfortunately, of income support that actually, when we tie it to employment and when we tie it to conditionality, in my opinion, replicates the systems of racial capitalism and privilege that many people don't in the labor market are excluded from. And these existing social assistance programs don't prevent or protect us from the insecure economy and all of us, right? But we know that this disproportionately harms Black and Indigenous and other people of color. It leaves people out, and we're in a time of, we're facing a prolonged, ongoing, severe overdose crisis and a COVID-19 crisis. And in these circumstances, our system, our underlying system of racial capitalism actually, produces worse outcomes for people who are already in very vulnerable situations. So I think that rather than, a distrust of the system, it's actually more about the potential and opportunity to protect everybody and to start to reject some of the underlying racism that's built into capitalism and built into some of these targeted and conditional models. So I do see a real opportunity. And, you know, it's not just me saying this, but, you know, the movement for Black Lives has supported a basic income. The report on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls has also called for a basic income. You'll see several leaders in the NDP party who have been working very actively with Indigenous allies who are also calling for a basic income. So I think we're talking about advancing an income security system that actually rejects some of the fundamental problems in our existing income and employment systems, and really calls for an approach to providing income for all of us that's grounded in human rights and fairness and equity. And so I think that's really, to me, what's more important to convey here is that philosophical difference that right now our income security systems, the way they are, they paternalize people, they police the way they spend their income, they force them to report on just about everything. And I don't think any amount of tweaking with that broken system is going to actually start to affect some of the underlying dynamics that are creating harm for those who are most vulnerable in our society.
That was Jenna Van Drenen, a director of the Basic Income Canada Network, and Mark Lee, senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. We talked about universal basic income in BC. And that's it for today. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO, your super local morning news show here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. I'm Jenny Tan Macy, and thank you so much for spending your Friday morning with us. As always, please tell us what you think of the show. I'm at Macy at coopradio.org. That's M-E-I-X-I at coopradio.org. Ciao. Take care.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.